very similar. Starting very small at a very young age, and it's been a journey.
Well, he just talked about flying reciprocating engines, T-6 and whatever. Yeah. So T-34, what was your, was that your only reciprocating aircraft engine?
Well, I started flying when I was in college, just using actually my student loans to get my private license. But it's funny you talk about the Bearcat having not needing that that rudder on a power edition, because even the T-34 with a little PT-6, it was 550 shaft horsepower, requires some right rudder as you both go down the runway at full power and climb away. So I'm not going to look that up. I'm really curious with the designers of this, how they got that to happen with such a powerful engine, because I've heard all the stories about the Corsairs and how dangerous that can be if not respected properly.
And you want to put the power in slowly.
Yeah.
This is different. You put the power in, you can be a little abusive, and it just takes it. Just keeps taking
That's
it.
That's amazing.
But you went then from T-34s, but that has a big engine. It's not these, that has a bigger engine than most of the ones here.
So you'll probably see in the line here, there might be a T-34C here. I haven't seen one, but the common ones you'll see are the Alpha and Bravo models, which have I believe it's 230 horsepower. It's a reciprocating engine. The Charlie, the Turbo Mentor, had the PT-6 turboprop motor, which significant more power. And that was used as a Navy trainer all the way up until just a few years ago, when they finally phased out the last T-34s for training, replaced by the T-6 Texan II. But they're still flying T-34s in some of the training commands. I flew them with my former command in Miramar. We'd use them as low-safe aircraft to monitor the dive altitudes of the various students. So I still got a chance to fly that turboprop, and I'll tell you, it was a... like you're saying, teaching you how to fly with your hands and your feet. Sometimes lost in fleet flying with our advanced fly-by-wire controls, but it's a pleasure to fly these, I call these real aircraft that you're using all your limbs to fly.
Real aircraft as opposed to the Hornet, you mean?
Hornet's a real aircraft, but it's a flying computer, but it does amazing things. But nothing like flying an aircraft with your hands and feet, like a T-34, or I can even imagine a Bearcat, that really brings you back to your aviating roots, so to speak.
No, Damon knows that my son was a naval aviator, flew Hornets, and he told me, he called me after his first flight one day, and he said, I was in the back seat under a hood for my friend. Look at the smile. And I said, in the first flight, you're under the hood in the back seat? And the guy said, it's your airplane? And you started from there, and he said, is that what happened with you, too, in the T-34?
In basic training, I don't know how that was then. I came a little bit after your son. We actually did a few flights from the front seat to start with, just to learn how to fly and pretty much take off and land the T-34. But right after that initial phase, yes, we call it back then it was called BIs, or basic instruments, and they'll throw you in the back seat, put a hood over your head, and you'll be flying basic maneuvers and approaches from the backseat with no visual reference. So just which all is very common in any kind of instrument training. But for a brand new student going into what we considered a high-performance propeller-driven aircraft like T-34, it was a big jump. But it's even a bigger jump today for the new students coming in the T-6-2 with T-6 Texan II, to having more power. But yeah, it was sink or swim pretty much from the backseat.
Boy, so how does this sound to you when you hear him describe his flying? Mm-hmm. Now, before we get to the Hornet, we'll talk about that later. Mm-hmm. But how does this sound to you hearing him describe this process of learning to fly these airplanes?
I wish I had the opportunity as a young man. You know, I tried. I have astigmatism, glasses, and I couldn't get in, couldn't meet those criteria, those high standards. But I would have done it for sure.
You know, the hood, just in the past few days, we were honoring then Lieutenant Colonel Jimmy Doolittle. And after, when he had left getting his PhD at MIT, did the first hooded flight. Wow. When you think back that Doolittle was the one for the first human being to put a hood over himself and fly instruments and take off and land, and how common that's become today. I mean, it's been a bunch of years, but it's...
That's amazing. I didn't know that fact. That's interesting.
He did some other neat stuff as well.
At least.
John and John. Yeah, where'd John go? Oh, he's gone.
Oh.
What happened to your John? So tell me, you're Chicago. Tell me about this airplane, where you fly it, and what you do with it on a regular basis.
All right, well, can I finish a little bit about...
Oh, yeah, please do.
I'd like to just real quick touch on the father of the Blue Angels was Butch Vorse, okay? Roy Butch Vorse, and Admiral Nimitz actually called him into duty and said, I want you to head up the new team. So he went back to the Hellcats, and they modified him, took all the weight out of him, and he grabbed some of his best instructors from Daytona Beach, Naval Air Station Daytona. They went out in the Everglades, and they practiced. And then their first flight was in Jackson, Naval Air Station Jackson, Jacksonville, Florida, with a trio of the Hellcats. And they had such notoriety that the press and everything, you know, took them to the Big Apple. Everybody's whining and dining them, and this is the greatest thing in the world. So it was big success, big press success. And one of the lieutenants went to a nightclub called the Blue Angel. So when Forrest heard that, he goes, that's the name. That's name similar to the Apollo. The Apollo series, bunch of guys, and they saw a big sign, a big picture of horses racing. And it said the Apollo. And they said, that's Apollo mission. You know, I mean, you can't make that kind of stuff up, right? Where do they get the names, right? Well, from a nightclub in New York. So then he started, you know, their first tour of duty there was from 46 to 47. The Korean War broke out, and they had a moratorium on it then. They had to go and fight that war. And they came back, and within a few years, they started up again with the Panther. So now they're jets.
F9F.
Now they're F9F, yeah. And the Panther was a great machine, but quite frankly, it wasn't really up to the Bearcat standards, because even though they committed the jets and said, in fact, some of the base commanders said, get the Bearcats off the field because all the pilots want to still fly it, and they're bitching that it's better, and we don't care if it's better because the next generation is going to be jet. So they literally removed them from the flight line because the guys were bitching so much they wanted to still fly them. So Boris is at Corpus Christi, Texas. First day, they're going to do a practice flight. Severe turbulence. And by the way, my first air show was Corpus Christi, Texas, and we landed in about a 40-mile-an-hour crosswind. And that thing takes a 50-mile-an-hour crosswind. I found that out real quick. This thing can take a crosswind where I'm not that great of a pilot, but this plane's a great plane because I couldn't want to see doing anything like that in a Corsair or a Mustang. And this thing can take a crosswind like it's not there, like no tomorrow. But so they go to go up on the next day, Saturday, and heck, weather's just as bad, like it can be at Corpus Christi. So finally, commander says, look, you're going to go up no matter what. We've got cadets out there. People want to be cadets. We got the State Department. We got to get money for our next generation. And you guys got to go up on Sunday. They went up. They hit severe wind shear. And one plane crashed. Forrest found himself inverted with his tail feathers almost all gone. And he was aiming at a pool full of children. Now, typical Vorz, he pushes Reds out, wakes up, climbing, gets the airplane to another field. He didn't want to land on that field. Saved the day. It would have been disastrous. But that was their introduction to jets. But what a great man, what a great story. And 20-plus years Navy aviator, he ended his career being a consultant on the lunar modules for landing. So he went from propellers to jets. Just amazing man. And like all of these fellas you hear about, I don't care if it's Lindbergh, I don't care who it is, you read one book and another book and another book, and there's another layer to the onion. These people just never gave up providing service to the country. And they never gave up challenging themselves. Really quite amazing.
You know, the F-9F, a lot of famous aviators flew the F-9F in Korea.
Sure.
John Glenn, for one.
Yeah.
Neil Armstrong also, and Ted Williams from the Red Sox flew the Panther in Korea.
That's a heck of an athlete, huh? He goes and gives up being a ball player to go and fight.
He did. Yeah. The second time. That's right. During World War II as well. So when you're listening to this history, how much do you get back into this history, Damon? So
the people
when you can. I mean, you can't do it.
The answer is when I can. You know, but growing up, I tried to immerse myself in the history as much as I can. It was definitely one of my primary areas of interest. And then I'm fortunate enough to represent Navy and Marine Corps as part of the Blue Angels. And Blue Angels are steeped in history of naval aviation. And talking to a gentleman like yourself about naval aviation. So I'm getting more exposed and get to dabble in that history more now than before. But honestly, in the fleet, we're flying, we're support guys on the ground out there. We're pretty much focused on the here and now. A little hate is there. I'm loving life, big smiles. I'm loving hearing all this again.
Listen, go back to the beginning, because when people see the Blues and they see you guys and they know how darn good you are at what you do, tell me the background from the time you started in the T-34C. And what are the steps you went through?
Yes, sir. So all naval aviators are commissioned officers in the United States Navy or Marine Corps. Various processes. They're selected to fly in a pilot spot. So I entered an OCS we call it SNA, or Student Naval Aviator, and went into, and everyone starts in Pensacola, as you saw in the on that brief video. We call that the Cradle Naval Aviation. So for what we call API, it's a 6 weeks aviation pre-flight indoctrination, where it's pretty much just the academic portions, learning about power plants, about aerodynamics, about weather. We'll just do that really big, just a basic foundation before we go off to our primary flight training, which is in both in Whiting Field and Naval Air Station Corpus Christi. And some guys actually go up and fly the T-6 in Oklahoma with the Air Force. So I went down to Corpus Christi for about 6-7 months through primary flight school in a T-34C. Selected, we call tailhook out of that. So that's selected a pipeline where everyone will fly aircraft off an aircraft carrier. And then from there, went into the T-45s to do my strike syllabus.
So that's a jet?
That's a jet, yeah. It's a T-45 Goshawk. It's basically a modified British Hawk that has been modified with landing gear and obviously many American systems. Basically, it's been equipped to take off and land off of our aircraft carriers.
And where were you? What base were you with the Goshawk?
Yes, that was Naval Air Station Meridian, Mississippi, but there's also training done in Naval Air Station Kingsville, Texas, which is very close to Corpus Christi.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you carrier qualify in the T-45?
Yes, we did. Student Naval Aviators will qualify on the T-45 first. So the first time you ever see a boat in the Navy, and it's probably been this way for a long time,